This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Well, hello, little one. You're here at the opening day of Disneyland. Where do you want to go? In front of you is Main Street, USA, where the clock has turned back half a century and all is quaint and dignified with small-town charm. Oh, and look over there! The great big castle where Sleeping Beauty lies. That's Fantasyland, the heart of the park, a land of chivalry, of enchantment and fairy tales, dedicated to all of those who believe that when you wish upon a star, dreams do come true. Oh, here comes Mr. Walt Disney now on the miniature steam train. And look who's at the wheel. It's Mickey Mouse. How about we hop on board and travel to Frontierland, where behind the stockades you can experience the romance and the drama of the American frontier. It's a tribute to the ingenuity of our hardy pioneers who blazed the trail and made this progress possible. I see. You're the type of kid who loves inventions. Well, then it's Tomorrowland for you, where the year is good old 1986, and cruises to the moon are an everyday thing. Earth is peaceful and unified and non-communistic. So what'll it be, little one? Where do you want to go? Well, hello and a warm welcome to Patented, my podcast about the history of inventions by History Hit. I'm Dallas Campbell. Yes, today we are talking about Disneyland, which is appropriate because I've actually just got back from Disneyland. Well, Disneyland Paris. I was there not for pleasure, I hasten to add. I was there for work. I gotta say, it's looking a bit tired, but there you go. What you just heard was my recreation, my low-quality recreation, of a really wonderful YouTube video documenting the day that the very first Disneyland opened amongst the orange groves of Anaheim in California, just south of Los Angeles, way back in good old 1955. And if you're familiar with today's Disneyland, it will maybe sound very familiar to you. The first park in Anaheim, the brainchild of Walt Disney, remains the blueprint for all the other Disneylands around the world. And as you might have picked up, whole ideology was encoded within the Disneyland. And we're going to talk a little bit about that in this episode. Anyway, that's according to my guest today, the very wonderful Sabrina Mittermeier, who is the world expert on Disneylands and author of A Cultural History of Disneyland Theme Parks, Middle Class Kingdoms. Absolutely fascinating discussion. I hope you enjoy it. Sabrina, welcome to the show. There's a lot to talk about. There's a lot to unpack. I'm aware there's a lot to unpack. Well, we're going to unpack it in all this kind of interesting intrigue and fun stuff in a moment. I just want to start with the kind of the origin story. And I've just come back from Disneyland, by the way. I was in Disneyland a couple of weeks ago.
I was there a couple of weeks ago, too. Maybe we were there at the same time.
Okay. I was in the French one, in the Paris one.
Oh, okay. I was in the Californian one.
We're in the Californian one. Okay. It's quite an odd experience. I've been to Disneyland a few times, and I always come away feeling slightly odd. And maybe you can explain why I sometimes come away feeling slightly odd. Let's clear up the origins first,
yeah,
if we can. Let's go back to good old 1955, I think. Yes. Was it 1955?
1955,
Back to the Future. Well, actually, why don't we start with who Walt Disney was? I mean, everyone's heard of Walt Disney, but he was an interesting character. In inverted commas.
I mean, first and foremost, he was a filmmaker. That's how he started out, obviously. Yeah. Animated films, animated cartoons in the 1920s and 30s. When that was a, you know, common thing to produce, because short cartoons were usually the thing you showed in theaters before a film, right? Or like...
He liked mice.
I mean, he liked rabbits, too, because his first rabbits creation was actually Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, or one of his first, anyway. But then he lost the rights to him, and he had to come up with something else, because otherwise his business would have been dead in the water. And that's the origin story of Mickey Mouse. But then, obviously, Up Iwerks is the guy who actually draws Mickey Mouse. Like, Walt Disney wasn't much of an animator himself. He was usually the guy who had ideas and sort of put people together. Like, I think he was a producer. He was a creative man, and he was a producer more than anything.
And what, I mean, as well as being a filmmaker, I mean, he was obviously, he had opinions about things. He had views about things. I'm just sort of, I'm interested in kind of where he stood kind of politically and what his views were on issues. You sighed really. That was a long sigh. Sabrina just raised her eyebrows and sighed at me.
It's a long sigh. My eyebrows usually give me away. Apparently I have that in common with Brett Goldstein. Anyway, so there's so many rumors. Obviously, people are very invested in who Walt Disney was for various reasons, because to so many people, he's like a hero or an almost mythic figure. But that also means that flip side of the coin, that so many people want to sort of destroy that image. And I think the reality of things is somewhere in the middle. The fact of the matter is, he was someone who was on the House Un-American Committee, like when all of the communist witch hunt was going on. He was one of those people who spoke out against communists. He also had an issue with his workers going on strike in the studio. He felt like that was betrayal rather than a normal, like, you know, labor action. So definitely he was a conservative. But I do want to shy away from, like, leaning into any of the other stuff. It's like, oh, he was a rabbit and he's Semite, or any of the other things, because there isn't that much proof for it. He was certainly very conservative. He was, I also hate saying he was a product of his time, but I also don't want to say he was more racist than the average white man of his generation would have been. So, you know what I mean?
But he seemed to represent a set of values, a particular sort of conservative American values at the time. He was very sort of caught up with that. You're right, there are lots of stories about Walt Disney. Most of them are probably nonsense. Like, his brain probably isn't frozen in a vat somewhere.
Yeah, or his whole body. Like, there's exactly, a whole cryogenically kind of frozen nonsense.
But so I guess that's buried. The thing. He's one of those characters that, because he solicits opinions, all this kind of mythology then grows up around him, and conspiracy theories and stories and what have you. It's quite hard to get to the sort of truth. Well, as we unpack the story of Disneyland, maybe we can touch on a few more of these. So he's an animator. He's fond of drawing, or not drawing, he's fond of mice and rabbits and these cartoons that I suppose also represent a set of quite sort of conservative American values of the times of the 1950s. Where did the idea of a theme park come from, and what was it, the first theme park? Did theme parks exist before Disneyland? I'm not sure. I mean, obviously there were fairgrounds, but not really.
No, I would say they didn't. Theme parks are, I would say, an invention of Walt Disney, or, you know, his team of designers, the Imagineers. Like, the way Disneyland works, it's the first theme park in that form. It definitely takes...
Can we just pause on that term, Imagineers? Is it obviously engineers, Imagineers? Was this the term that Disney came up with?
Yeah, probably not Disney himself. Like, a lot of the stuff that's credited to Walt Disney as a person, like certain quotes and so on, often they were written by other people. Like, he had a speechwriter, obviously. He had someone who came up with a lot of this. Marty Sklar, most of the time, has said or written the things that are credited to Walt Disney. He was someone who was with the company for a very, very long time with Walt Disney Imagineering. Mm-hmm. He only very recently passed away, actually. But Imagineering, yes, it's a portmanteau of imagination and engineering, and it's something the company came up with.
It seems like, you know, there were lots of filmmakers, but it seems like he was very, very conscious of image and the way he projected things, and the way and the values that his films and ideas encapsulated. Is that fair?
I think so. Yeah, I think what did make Walt Disney stand out among other filmmakers or studio heads or any of the time was that he was always looking for something new or something else or something different. And he definitely had great ideas. He had a great feeling for like the zeitgeist in a way. Like he always seemed to know what would do well, what would sell.
Yes.
He always knew how to hire the right people to get, you know, like he was good at that. And that's why I'm saying he's probably the original producer, or at least what a producer should be doing, with the exception that he wasn't the guy for the money. That was his brother, apparently. Like, he didn't have a good grip on, like, financial stuff. Mm. Like, he was usually thinking outside of the box.
I'm the same. Yeah. I'm the same. okay, so he's making films.
Yeah.
He's wrapped up in, I suppose, politics and other things. But the theme park, like, what happened? Like, what are the origins of this Disneyland, Disney World idea?
It's several things at once. So the first thing is that coming out of World War II, he's quite disillusioned with filmmaking, because during World War II, or when the U.S. enters World War II, all the studios are being conscripted by the U.S. government to produce World War II propaganda. They don't have the same creative freedom anymore. And so he's looking for something else to do. His doctors also tell him to slow down and, you know, find a hobby, essentially. He was always interested in miniatures and miniature railroads. Mm-hmm. He also had a, you know, bigger scale railroad in his own backyard. A lot of these things, he was very into, like, Americana, so he would build these miniatures of, like, American scenes and all of this kind of comes together. He also goes on a long trip around Europe in the early 1930s, where he goes to Germany, he goes to Denmark, so places like Tivoli Gardens. So there's a few places that would later inspire Walt Disneyland. Tivoli Gardens is one of them.
Tivoli Gardens, I've been there actually, in Denmark. Just remind our listeners what Tivoli, because that's kind of a theme park, isn't it?
It's sort of, yeah, weird. It's an amusement park. It's one of the, like, nicer ones, because it's in gardens, so there's all that landscaping. There's all that, like, what he liked about it was the landscaping, the cleanliness of the park. It was less geared at, like, a working class audience as well. So that's a big thing, actually, for him.
That's interesting. I mean, where amusement parks and arcades generally kind of working class seen as a bit dirty, a bit grimy, a bit...
Definitely. So that's one of the things. So he's obviously of a generation where he would have grown up with these things, but they were already sort of on the way out, like, as a form.
Yes.
So they come up in the late 19th century. They're obviously still around in the early 20th century, but then also through the Great Depression and everything, like, a lot of them fall into disarray. And even before that, they're working class entertainment. They're built at the end of trolley parks. So, you know, at the end of, like, streetcars, because that's where the electricity is. They use basically the leftover electricity on the weekends when nobody's going to work. So he doesn't like them as much because they're very raucous. A lot of people drink there, people smoke there, people have sex there. And that's not the environment he wants to, like, create. Like, he's looking to create an environment you can go to with your family, where you can play together with your kids rather than just watch your kids on a playground. You know, that's something that comes to his mind. So he likes amusement parks. He's obviously familiar with them, but, like, he likes the rides, but he doesn't like the atmosphere.
So he wants to create a sort of family, middle-class, wholesome sort of theme park environment. And it's the idea that, is the theme of the theme park, is the idea kind of, oh, we're going to take my films and base all the kind of rides around the films? Is that, is it kind of a stepping into a Disney film? Is that the idea?
Yes and no. Like, it's part of it. So one of the things is that Walt Disney Studios are, to this day, one of the only studios, working studios in LA that don't have a studio tour. So it's not open to the public. So it's also sort of, even at that point in time, creating a place of, like, oh, people are interested in visiting the Disney Studios. We don't actually want to open them up. So there is that factor of, like, oh, what is it like to visit Disney, or like, visit Disney's worlds? Not necessarily from the how to make a film standpoint, but, like, immerse yourself in the Disney world, which is most clearly possible in Fantasyland. But there's other things too. It's also immersing yourself in other types of atmospheres and ideas. Mm-hmm. So
okay, so he's come up with this idea of, okay, I want to open a theme park a bit like the one in Denmark, yeah. but clean and no sex, because obviously sex is terrible.
Yeah, sex is terrible.
We know that. What happened? How did just talk us through a little bit of the process of where are we? Is it? It's the California one was the first one, wasn't it? I think at Anaheim.
Anaheim, yeah.
Tell us about how it happened.
That actually happens rather quickly. So there's a weekend that sort of enters the annals of history as the lost weekend, because him and I believe Herb Ryman, who was one of his animators, like he works with a bunch of his animators who are already working for a studio in this, draws up like this basic map of Disneyland, what exists at this point basically in Walt Disney's head. And they use that to pitch it to investors. And obviously everyone is like, why would you want to do this? Including some brothers, like, this is not, we don't know, nobody has done this before. What do you want to do? Like, they obviously take it to banks. They need funding for it. But he also uses his own life insurance as collateral. But at the end, because his brother's also like, you can't use all of your studio's money. Like, this is way too risky. We might go bankrupt. But he scrapes the money together. He hires like consultants to find a good location for it. They land on Anaheim. At that point, Anaheim is just orange groves. Like LA isn't what LA is now.
It's all just orange groves in LA. There's nothing else. It's just oranges.
No, I mean, LA exists. But I mean, if you've been to Anaheim now, it's not orange groves. So
it's really not.
So they buy up some land and actually they build all of Disneyland within a year. Like, it goes fairly quickly from conception to the final product, and it's insane. Like, if you look at how long it takes to build one attraction nowadays, which is obviously multiple factors, and I think
that's the multiple factors why everything takes a long
time. Zoning laws, all of this nonsense, but also how funding works, how everything works, how labor laws work. I mean, a lot of it is also actually good because it protects people that work on these things, but like, I think it was less complicated.
Okay, so it's day one. Disneyland opens. The gates open. I always think a bit like Willy Wonka. Do you remember that bit in Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory with Gene Wilder? Does that?
But
that
no
happens.
Children were harmed in the opening of Disneyland.
No children harmed. What am I seeing? Take me inside. I'm greeted by a mouse person in a mouse outfit. And then what do I see?
Probably, yeah. You walk on Main Street USA, which is sort of a miniaturized past. So that's what it's been called anyway. It's a small town America at the turn of the century.
But in miniature.
Sort of. It's the buildings are built to scale, so the ground floors you can actually walk in on. So there's usually Main Street USA is mostly stores and restaurants. But the second floor is gate. Like, it comes from how we build studio sets, like film studio sets. Obviously, people who build it were actually studio set designers. So, you know, that's what happens. And then walk down that stretch, you get to Central Plaza, you see Sleeping Beauty Castle.
And was it the happiest place in the world?
Opening day was a disaster. It actually, ends up being called, I think, what, Black Sunday? I think it was a Sunday.
Black Sunday, that's...
Someone will correct me, and it was a different day of the week.
The Disney lawyers who are all over this will be correcting you. They'll be
fans, they're much worse.
Oh, the fans. Oh, God. Yeah, we'll come on to that. Remind me to talk about the fans.
Oh, God, the internet. We forgot about the internet. So it's a disaster, because what happens is, obviously, they issue tickets to people. Mm. More people show up than were invited, because there's black market tickets, and some people allegedly climb over the walls. Because it was built that quickly, apparently, like, it's a very, very hot day. So this is July in Anaheim.
That's horrific.
So a lot of the ground is not... What are roads made of?
Tarmac. Asphalt.
The asphalt. Yeah, the asphalt isn't fully dry. And because it's that hot, people, like a few people, women especially, sink into the ground in their heels. There aren't enough water fountains, I think, because they had some plumbing issues earlier. It's a big disaster because it's just extremely busy. And it's all televised as well.
So you can actually see, is there videos? Can you YouTube them?
Yeah. So the thing is with the televised thing is one of the ways he ended up actually funding all of this is that he was smart enough, and not many studio bosses at the time worked with television, because television was the enemy and a medium everyone was sort of like... skeptical of.
Well, it was new. It was new and powerful.
It was new, yeah. So, and Disney was like, no, this is great, actually. And he collaborated with what was the third network at the time, and there were only three, ABC, and made a deal with them to create a television show for them that was basically one long commercial. It would come on once a week. It lasted an hour, and they created all of this content for it that was basically a commercial. So they would create the Davy Crockett films for it that were extremely successful. Mm-hmm. Davy Crockett was basically what Frozen was a few years ago. Like, everyone had the merchandise, everyone knew the song everywhere. Like, it was global as well, or at least Western world.
Remind us who Davy Crockett was. He was a sort of frontiersman.
Yeah, he was a frontiersman at the Alamo in Texas, yeah. The Texan War of Independence. Not the most likely character, especially because he dies at the Alamo. But it's the American folk hero. At least Walt Disney's version of it actually turns him into the massive American folk. I was just at the Alamo, actually, in Texas, so for the first
Remember
time.
Remember the Alamo.
Yeah.
Just pause there for a moment, Sabrina. I just want to, just while we're on the opening day and we've got women in heels sinking into the asphalt,
yeah,
just give us a sense of what the place would have looked like. Like, were there rides? Were there roller coasters? And what was the...
It looked a lot like it does today, but obviously some different attractions and less of them in total. But the basic structure of Disneyland is the same in 1955 than it is today, and it is in most other Disneylands in the world. So you enter in Main Street, USA, which looks like almost exactly the same as it does today. You walk down, you would see Sleeping Beauty Castle, which also looks pretty much as it does today. You can turn left into Adventureland, which looks very similar to what it does today, because the Jungle Cruise already existed, which takes up most of that space. The Indiana Jones ride wouldn't have existed. That's opened in 1993. But like, Adventureland pretty much there. The Treehouse was there. New Orleans Square wouldn't have been there yet. So Pirates of the Caribbean, that opens during Walt Disney's lifetime, however, in the early 1960s. The Tiki Room also opens in the early 1960s, but you know, the basic structure is this. You would have walked into Frontierland, you would have seen the Mark Twain riverboat, you would have seen the Rivers of America, all of that was there. There was a mine train ride that wasn't a roller coaster, but it was there too. There would have been, I think there would have been some live animals at that point, like farm animals, and there would have been an Indian village, so Native American thing. Fantasyland was there with a bunch of the dark rides that exist until today, like Snow White, like the ride through the miniature.
It's things. A small like world.
No, it's a small world comes later. Sorry. That's built for the New York World's Fair in 1964, but it's not much, it's not far off.
So, but basically what he's created seems to be this world of nostalgia. He seems to be creating a kind of mythic idea of the American dream, a sort of portrait of an American dream that a certain class of people can come.
Yes, 100%, but it's not just nostalgia for the past, it's also a utopian future, because there's also Tomorrowland.
Well, we'll come to that in a minute. I'm just on the Wikipedia page, actually, and
I
just want to read out the original.
It's
a great source of information. It's always correct, Wikipedia. But it's got the Walt Disney original dedication on it. To all who come to this happy place, welcome. Disneyland is your land. Here age relives fond memories of the past, and here youth may savour the challenge and promise of the future. Disneyland is dedicated to the ideals, the dreams, and the hard facts that have created America, with the hope it will be a source of joy and inspiration to the world.
Yes.
That's kind of it, isn't it? It's nostalgia and this what we want the future to be.
Yeah, it's what I have argued is that it's all of the ideology and ideals of the early Cold War.
On American History Hit, we ride the wild Oregon Trail, delve deep beneath Central Park, and fight the forgotten war of 1812. Join me, Don Wildman, and my expert guests as we uncover the stories that have shaped America in all its endless complexity. We'll follow John Wilkes Booth as he shoots President Lincoln and goes on the run. And we'll walk under the stars with Harriet Tubman as she finds her way to freedom. Follow America's story from the first Native people to footprints on the moon. On American History Hit, a podcast by History Hit, with new episodes every Monday and Thursday. Follow us wherever you get your podcasts.
But that idea of nostalgia, the past and the future kind of mixing together, and the values that are encompassed in that, that sort of then lent itself to this idea of the Epcot Center, this idea of creating separate kind of future worlds.
Yeah, well, if we want to jump ahead to that, then we're jumping ahead several years
We are.
But, yeah.
You know, you talked about your Cold War thesis, so let's just mention that,
yes.
And then we'll jump
let's
to
do
Epcot.
The Cold War, and then we can do more of the Cold War, because that doesn't end for a while. The early Cold War, I think, is very much distilled in 1955 Disneyland, because you have everything. You have Main Street USA, which is nostalgia for the past that never actually existed. You know, American values, American ideology. You go into Frontierland, which is called Frontierland, not Westernland. You know, that alone is ideology. But also the Western genre was super, super popular in the early Cold War for good reason, because it's all black and white, good versus evil, you know, like some of the metaphors there aren't very subtle. Davy Crockett was super popular with kids as well. You have Fantasyland, which is just escapism. You have Adventureland, which is escapism, but also racism or exoticism. You know, the idea of like traveling to foreign worlds that wouldn't have been as accessible to people at the time, because, you know, the jet age is sort of happening, but most people still can't afford to fly all these places all the time. And then there's Tomorrowland with all its like, you know, utopian visions of the future, space travel, technology, also domestic living plays a massive role in the early Tomorrowland. So, you know, everyone, like, or not everyone, but the white middle class was obsessed with like getting new kitchen appliances and washing machines or whatever, and like, you know, ideas of future living. So that's all there. And there's all these tensions, right? It's all about like nostalgia, but also future. And you have like all these Western heroes like Davy Crockett, but you're also reassured by all the fantasy. Like it's all like sort of distilled in the park.
You know, you've painted this really clear picture of the kind of values that are encompassed. Obviously, the context of it, this Cold War, American exceptionalism, good versus evil, the space race, the jet age, all this technology that was coming online. I want to go back to this idea of Epcot. Just explain what the Epcot
yes.
Center is and how that, the Epcot, I'm thinking Epcot, Florida, these sort of future ideas of utopian futures that were built, and how that ties in with Disney.
Yeah, so that was the last thing Walt Disney did before he died, was that he...
What does Epcot stand for?
Yeah, so the acronym stands for the Experimental Prototype Community of Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. And he pitched it as a city. Like, he wanted to do was build a city. So new ways of living, like a prototype, as he says, a prototype community. He had grand visions of, like, public transportation as well, which is very, you know, rare for the U.S. to this very day. Gets as far as making a little image film, buys an extreme amount of land, like 10 times the size of Manhattan. Like, it's several times the size of Manhattan. And he buys all that land outside of Orlando, Florida, because land there is cheap, it's warm there, and it's already a tourist destination, and he wants to build a city. And he doesn't get further than that because he dies. So his Imagineers and the rest of the company are left with this concept that they soon figure out wouldn't work.
Anything with a monorail is a vision of a utopian future, basically.
Yes, even though it comes from Wuppertal, Germany.
Is that right? Everything comes
from Germany.
Yeah,
that's where Disney found them. Like, Disney was driving through Germany with his wife, and then suddenly he saw the monorail.
Was his family from Germany, Disney?
No,
German connection?
Like, they tried to make up a French connection when Euro Disney opened, but that's also fabricated, I believe. His family is very much, he's from around Chicago.
So what happened to Epcot? Disney dies, but what was the end result?
What happens to Epcot? The end result is that, so to finance Epcot as a city, what they do is build another Disneyland. So they built the Magic Kingdom Park, and they built a few hotels around it. So they actually also found sort of that idea of the resort, you know, like having a one-stop shop vacation where you don't have to leave the property for a week or so, which also has to do with how many vacation days the Americans have, not many. And they built that and opened it at 71. But by then, they've already started to realize that this idea for a city, it's not very fleshed out, and they don't think they can do that. So they turn the concept into another theme park, but it takes till 1982 to do that. And the way Epcot stands until today is very close to what a World's Fair would have looked like or still looks like. It's also been sort of, you know, taken over a bit more by like Disney property and to the chagrin of some fans as well. But like, it's obviously shifted. It also has to go with the times of what people want from it. But they still hold like food festivals there and stuff. So
tell me about, you mentioned fans. Tell me about the fans. We mentioned that at the beginning. You kind of have a special relationship with the fans.
I mean, I'm a fan. So like, I'm firmly a fan of Disney and of the Disney parks, so I'm part of that fandom. And there's a lot of discussions about them, because obviously it's a massive fandom. It's a very active fandom, but they're also always, they're a lot in the spotlight. Like, that term Disney adult has come up. I don't know if you've heard of that, but it was a thing on the internet. Like,
why? Can I ask why you're a fan? Like, what? I mean, you've studied. You've written a book about Disney. Yeah. You go into the nitty gritty, and it's not always comfortable. Where does the fandom come from? Like, what? Where does that spring from?
I mean, so obviously, as so many people, I grew up at Disney. I'm born in 1989, so I grew up with the Disney Renaissance films. You know, like, I mean,
1989. Jesus. That's so annoying. Sorry. 1989.
I'm 33.
It's not annoying. Yeah. I'm joking.
So yeah, obviously I grew up with like the Disney Renaissance films. So like Little Mermaid, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Lion King, all of that. Yeah. And then I'm from Germany. So Euro Disney, as it's still called, then opens in 92. So my parents take me at some point when I'm like 4 years old. So it goes back to us with so many people to my childhood. But
well, you're right. There is that. But there is a great spectacle when you walk in. It is impressive. You know, there's great castles and roller coasters. There is something magical about these great things.
It is that. And I mean, as a kid for sure, but also it still works as an adult because it's just very well done. And there's that level of immersion where you just feel, you do feel sort of safe there, and it's fun, and you get to do fun things, and you go with your friends or your family. I also go alone quite a bit also because of my research, but I'm also used to it. Like, I just like to exist there. And I mean, also for me, there's always a factor of like, I'm a woman, I'm a young woman. I've not always felt safe by myself everywhere in the world. That's a sad fact. That's a space I completely feel safe in. Like, there's value to that. And I think there's value to that if you're there with kids. Whereas it's also that factor of like, you can do it with several groups of people or different age groups, you know, multi-generational family stuff or just bigger friend groups. And then also because the parks are that old, they also have their own fandom. There's just fans of the parks who grew up with these things that only exist in Disneyland.
So it's still that nostalgia, isn't it? Or it seems to be that nostalgia.
Yeah, it's always there. I think it's always there. There's sometimes our own childhoods now, like my generation would have also has all that nostalgia because we grew up with it. So, and then people are starting to take their kids. I don't have them, but like, I mean, people my age certainly do have kids. So it just keeps going. So
it's interesting actually how you sort of tread this interesting space between being an academic and looking at it with through the eyes of an academic. And then when you go in, you're in this sort of interesting kind of bubble of parallel universe of warmth and almost like a sort of security blanket away from the horrors of reality.
And I'm not the only one like that either. Like, it's a certain interesting juxtaposition of like, I can see all of this very critically and still sort of find something good in it. And I mean, it's the same if you study any other media, really. Like, there's so much to know about the film industry or entertainment industry you'd rather not know, and you still go out and enjoy film.
Just finally, it's been actually fascinating talking about this. What is the future of Disney? Is it what's the trajectory? Where, you know, as the world changes so radically, as the politics and cultural issues shift so quickly, I wonder what. Does Disney keep up with them all, or does it cling on to the past?
I think they're always trying to adapt to whatever is going on in the world. They're always trying to walk this very fine line of never wanting to offend anybody, and that's no longer possible. It never has been possible, but I feel like it's much more in the spotlight right now how difficult that is. And I mean, I think their future, I think they still have incredible staying power because their fandom is that large.
I'm always surprised. I was in Disneyland Paris the other day, and it's the 30th anniversary of it, and they were sort of redesigning lots of their merchandise with the sort of Mickey Mouse logo. And I'm like, young people have no idea idea about Mickey Mouse. Like, who watches Mickey Mouse? I mean, it's kind of interesting how the Mickey
they
Mouse...
They do, because, I mean, Mickey, like, there's so many different versions of Mickey by now. Like, I mean, we don't have really, like, the Disney Channel was a thing for a long time, but even if we were in a country without Disney Channel, there would have always been old cartoons on.
Yeah,
I grew up watching Disney and Mickey Mouse cartoons from the 30s.
I remember the Mickey Mouse Club, I remember, in the 1980s.
Yeah, there was one in Germany, a type of thing like that too when Eurodisney opened. Like, and now we have streaming, so everything's on Disney Plus. People can discover all this stuff. And they also produce like newer kids shows. There's a thing called Mickey Mouse Clubhouse that's CG animated for little kids. Like, I don't think that will ever go away. Like, people watch them. So
when you wrote your book and you sort of finished your book, was there a kind of a central thesis that you found that you kind of go, you know what, this is what I've discovered about.
Yeah, well, this. The one thing is that if you look at the parks, it's always about, you know, looking at the context of the time and the culture of the opening. And so, as I say, 1955 Cold War, like, you can look at it and find something out about that. You can tell a lot about what Western Europe was like in 1992 if you look closely enough at Eurodisney. Maybe less in the design, but if you look at everything that went down at the opening and the reaction to it, stuff like that. And the other big thing is that from the beginning, they've always appealed to a white middle class. At some point, the middle class wasn't as white anymore, but they still appeal to a white, like a middle to upper class, at least with their parks. Obviously, with other media, it's a bit different because they're more accessible to them, but that's their core audience for their parks, and as long as they target them well, they will keep going.
When archaeologists in hundreds of years' time dig up Disneyland, they'll find all this. They'll go, yes, I wonder if they'll be able to read all that from the ruins.
I wonder. I mean, things change so much. And then there's also the thing with, well, we're probably going to die in a global heat death and nothing will be left. But, there's people who say, oh, if they're on Earth, they think it will be a kingdom built to a mouse. But you can't find much of Mickey in the park. Yeah.
The conspiracy theorists will go crazy when they discover Disneyland. They'll go absolutely mad.
Yeah, I think Disney doesn't really have much to worry about quite yet.
No. Anyway, 1950s, Disneyland, interesting times then, interesting times now.
Yes. Well.
Sabrina, thanks for coming by and chatting. It's been really fascinating.
You're
welcome. It's, who, I mean, it just opens, you know, you talk about a theme park and it opens this great book on all kinds of...
Yeah, there's so much more. We have not barely like, scraped the surface, I think.
So. We've had a little scrape and it's been fun.
Yeah.
So thank you.
You're welcome.
So there we go. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you had that little virtual tour of Disneyland. Not the standard tour of Disneyland. If you're enjoying the show generally, don't forget to go back and have a little root around our what is becoming quite an extensive back catalogue of ideas and things that we've covered, things that we have delved into the origins of. And if you're enjoying it, we'd love you to tell your friends and your family and whoever that you're enjoying it, it would be greatly appreciated. And of course, as ever, don't forget to get in touch if you've got a suggestion for an episode, a topic perhaps you'd like us to cover. You can email us at patented@historyhit.com or you can give me a poke on social media. And I would love to hear from you. And I look forward to your company next time.
When you earn your degree online at Arizona State University, you get everything the nation's most innovative university has to offer. The same internationally recognized faculty, the same nationally ranked programs, the same degree. Learn more at asuonline.asu.edu.
While I still have you, very briefly, if you fancy getting all of the History Hit podcast archive and new episodes ad-free, along with hundreds of history documentaries to watch, download our app across Apple App Store, Google Play, and smart TV platforms. Follow the link in the show notes or go to historyhit.com/subscribe. There is thousands of hours of history on there, including a documentary on science in the Middle Ages with Seb Volk, and also one with me talking about the secret history of the space race. As a patented listener, you get a special gift if you use the code Patented at the checkout. You get 50% off your first 3 months. That's Patented for 50% off your first 3 months. And if you're an Apple listener, you can subscribe for new ad-free podcast episodes within the Apple app.